Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Today's Golazzo reacts to Juve Ajax and takes a look back at the last time the old lady actually won this competition, 1996, when Pinturicchio and co. met the Dutch Masters and gave themselves a real shot in the arm. All that, plus the latest Serie A news, and are Juve about to blow the title too in Golazzo? Momentous midweek in Turin, and joining us on Wednesday morning is Gabriele Marcotti.
Morning, James.
And on the line from the foot of the Alps, James Horncastle.
Good morning.
Good morning to you, James. You were at the Allianz Stadium Tuesday night to witness that masterclass from the young Ajax.
I was indeed, yes. Very impressive they were in the second half, producing some scintillating passages of play, which I think we've become gradually accustomed to over the course of this competition. And Juventus could do nothing but hold their hands up at the end. I think it was quite revealing how Andrea Agnelli, the president, came out afterwards, Max Allegri, all the players, and said, they can have no complaints. Ajax completely deserved to go through. And Juventus, I think what was really disappointing is, I mean, if you look over the course of the two legs, apart from the two Ronaldo headers, they never really troubled Onana in the Ajax goal. And I think what we saw with the limits of this style that Juventus have, and particularly the limits in midfield, because when it came to try and beating that first line of Ajax's press, so often, particularly in the second half, they were just unable to do it.
And the scoreline could have been so much worse than 2-1, Gab.
Yeah, it's a funny one, because Allegri pointed out afterwards that, you know, Ajax scored 3 goals and basically 2.5 of them were essentially defensive mistakes. But the thing is, even if they defended perfectly, you then tot up the number of chances that Ajax created. Either they finished badly, or Szczęsny made a great save, or that incredible Tadic one where he's wide open instead of shooting on goal, he decides to take one more pass, Wenger style. Or indeed, the one where Pjanic makes that tremendous recovery. I was watching on Sky Italia the post game, which is pretty darn good, because you got Fabio Capello, Billy Costacurta, Ale Del Piero, Paolo Condò, and then Andrea Pirlo, who's actually the most boring out of all of them, although probably the coolest. And they made the point, and they asked Allegri, you know, how's it possible that over 4 halves of football, for 3 halves, arguably you were pretty much even, but then you had that 20 minutes, that half hour, where you were absolutely annihilated, and Juve didn't have a passage of play or an equivalent period where they were on top, where they had Ajax on their back foot. And I think they went all in to bring in Cristiano in the summer. They saw him as a missing link. And financial fair play, believe me, is a thing. They're in a situation where they've basically mortgaged the house to get Cristiano. I mean, Marco Iaria, who's sort of Gazzetta dello Sport's kind of finance guy, he sort of estimated that between lost revenue from advancing further in the competition and other, you know, home gates and whatever, they were looking at, you know, at a loss of 30 to 40 million. On top of that, there's going to be a hit, obviously commercially, between winning it and not winning it. You know, you can't go and say, all right, you know, things didn't work out. Let's go and change everything up and have a rebuilding year, transition year. Because Cristiano, rightly, doesn't do rebuilds at his age. So it's still going to be a team that's built to win here and now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the difference is if the issue is, and I think, and I agree with James, you know, I think, you know, there was a sluggishness to them. They did kind of look old and whatever. The question is, how do you get around that? How do you improve that while also balancing the books? You only have so many saleable assets.
Right. Should they have been on dope this time, do you think, James?
Look, I mean, I think we're going to see a big overhaul in the summer. I think they will look to recoup some of the money that they invested last year, although we've already seen this, and this has caused some controversy in Italy, that the amount of money they've been able to pull in for the likes of Mandragora, Emil Aldero, Alberto Cerri, who's at Cagliari, all these no-name kids who are actually pretty good, but they're getting 20 million each for them. I think it'd be very interesting to see what happens with the likes of Buster in the summer, with Alexandro, with Khedira, even though those last two guys have signed new contracts recently. I mean, all this week, it's been, oh, look who's coming to town. Ryla's here. Jorge Mendes is here. They're going to be talking about João Félix and all these kind of players. I struggle to imagine how they can afford those guys, given what Gab has just outlined in terms of their financial situation. I also struggle to see how those guys are there, you know, what they are missing at the moment. Because, to be honest, what's been very noticeable both in Amsterdam and last night, you know, when it comes to being able to dominate the game through possession, being able to hold on to the ball high up the pitch, being able to break down teams with, you know, sophisticated passing patterns, they just don't have anyone other than Miralem Pjanic. You know, Emre Can, Matuidi, those guys can't really do that. So, you know, how they go about finding someone else who can basically come and add something to that to their game in that respect, I think is something that is missing. And, you know, in addition to, you know, the defense that they've built so much of their success on over the last few years, Bonucci, I think, Gab has raised this on a number of occasions, Bonucci, I just don't think is really fit for purpose anymore, the same player that he was. I can understand them bringing him back from a dressing room experience point of view to fill the gap that was left by Buffon, but it's been very disappointing. And again, last night, I mean, he was playing on the wrong side, not his favourite side, because Rugani was playing. Rugani did very well in the first leg, but again, the playmaking that we usually see from Bonucci at the back was kind of, you know, mitigated because he was on that side. And I think they might have to look at this and think, well, it's only getting so far.
Juve have been bad all season. Regular listeners will know. I mean, not, and you can say, well, but look, they're running around with Serie A. Serie A must all be pants. And yeah, there's obviously issues with teams, as there have been. But I just think this season is a season that Juve really got extremely fortunate domestically. And in a whole bunch of games, what games have you seen Juve play well against top sides this season?
Atletico Madrid,
Napoli.
Yeah.
There's maybe a couple others where they went and they flattened them. Whereas I feel like last season, you know, obviously they had the wobble at the end and it was a lot tighter, but I feel like last season this was just a much better unit. And I know it sounds crazy that you can add Cristiano and get worse.
Well, sometimes that happens. Look at the Sprilia at Newcastle.
This is true. And you can go back and listen to Tino Asprilla Golazzo, which I heartily recommend.
It is worth agreeing with you that they were up against a particularly awesome, a vintage Ajax side. All right, so just one Italian team left in Europe now. Napoli, who trailed by 2 goals to Arsenal from the first leg at the Emirates. Before we let you go, James, what do you think their chances of a comeback are on Thursday?
I think they can turn it around. I mean, we've seen Arsenal's away record, and they've been kind of fortunate that they've had the second leg off more often than not at the Emirates, where they've been able to correct defeats to Rennes, defeats to Bate Borisov. And, you know, I think we all know that Napoli are a much better side than those two. So I think Napoli can still progress in this competition. So I'm actually relatively confident.
James Horncastle in Turin. What do you think, Gab? Napoli 2-0 down for the first leg at the Emirates?
I was at that game. Arsenal were fantastic in the first half for 45 minutes. Napoli were terrible. But as James said, Arsenal away from home have their issues. They were so, so lucky on Monday night against Watford. So, yeah, I obviously Arsenal are favourites because a 2-goal lead, still a 2-goal lead. But I agree. I, maybe give Napoli a 40% chance.
You're listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show.
Last time on Galazzo, we were discussing Roma and we left things with them losing the then European Cup final at the Stadio Olimpico in Rome to Liverpool in 84. The next time the European final would be held there was a balmy early summer evening in May 1996, it was, when, guess who? Juventus and Ajax were facing for the Champions League final. But it was also the time of this. While in the UK they're all vibing to that, in Italy, how about this from those Backstreet Boys? Non puoi lasciarmi così, non mi lasciare, lo sai. And against that kind of musical backdrop, two teams taking the field at the Stadio Olimpico. Ajax, who were the champions of Europe, who had conceded only two goals on the way to this final, scoring 21, who beaten another Italian side, Milan, in the Champions League final just the year before, 1-0 in Vienna, who were facing, though, a Juve team who, am I right, Gab, were kind of regarded as the gold standard of a well-constructed European side.
Yeah, they had this incredible mix of quality and athleticism. I mean, there was almost a distinction, you know, between teams who played and teams who ran. And if you were bad, then you ran. That Juve side was the team that could run and could play. Wonderfully put together by Marcello Lippi, who I think also had the great merit of going to, you know, quote-unquote quality players like Ale Del Piero and Gianluca Vialli. I mean, Gianluca Vialli was always an athletic hard worker, but sort of saying like, all right, we're going to play three strikers. The third guy's going to be that weirdo with the white hair. Don't mind him. But you guys, if you want to have three dudes up there, you guys all have to make this work so we can keep our balance. And they did. They embraced it.
Mm. They were a team that always had a lot in their locker, as a court case was subsequently to establish. But we'll touch on all of that later. It's a story that I think is still close to a lot of Ajax hearts. But those lineups, these are the starting 11s on the 22nd of May, 1996. Edwin van der Sar in goal for Ajax. Their backline, Winston Bojada, Frank de Boer. How do you pronounce Sonny Siloy?
Sonny Siloy.
Siloy, okay. Danny Blind, Edgar Davids, Yari Litmanen, Ronald de Boer, and up front, Kiki Musampa, who I must admit I had forgotten, Nwankwo Kanu, the legend, and Finidi George. Juve lined up against them with Peruzzi, a back four of Pesotto, Ferrara, Ciro Ferrara, Vierkawod, and Moreno Torricelli. Didier Deschamps was in midfield alongside Paolo Sousa and Antonio Conte. And how about this for a front three? Gianluca Vialli, that weirdo with white hair, and Alessandro Del Piero. Wow. So the whistle blows, and in a marked contrast to what happened this week in 2019, it was Juve who got in Ajax's faces immediately. There's Torricelli, the legend, that kind of fresh down from La Pietà Christ figure, rough-hewn, hand-carved out of some old bit of timber.
An amateur footballer into his early 20s who supported himself as a carpenter, playing for, among other teams, the legendary Juve Domo. He was in Juve Domodossola from the hamlet of Domodossola in the north of Italy. So he happens to be near my summer house.
Right. And the legend always was that he was playing for a works team when they took on Juve in a pre-season friendly and impressed Trapattoni so much that he acquired his rights for the equivalent of about £16,000. Torricelli went on to become one of the stars of that Juve. I mean, one of the legends of that Juve team. Gepetto. Yeah.
You read off all the names. There's tremendous names. But I would invite you to look at this starting 11 and ask yourself, who on this team can pass and pass well and pass creatively? I would submit Paolo Sousa, obviously. I mean, talk about, you know, matinee idol. The guy could do whatever he wanted. And obviously Del Piero. The other guys, this is a blue-collar team. I'm not suggesting Antonio Conte and Deschamps were bad players, but that's what made things so differently. You know, that was sort of the contrast, not so much in technical ability, but in the way they expressed it. Even the defenders, you know, I mean, Torricelli you've covered, Vierco, poor guy, tremendous, but he was also about 50 years old at the time. And, you know, Ciro Ferrara, another guy who really was a proper defender. Bisotto could put in crosses, but, you know, never beat a guy. So you put these things together, you know, this really was kind of, you know, the triumph of the hardworking athletic side. And that's also with, you know, the little cherries on top that was Del Piero. And obviously Vialli and Ravanelli who could finish, but, you know, you wouldn't necessarily call them, you know, that those creative, exciting players. And contrast that with the guys on the other side for Ajax, and it's no contest.
Right. 8 seconds in, Torricelli launches himself in on Bojardi, lets him know he's in a game. The first touch from Alessandro Del Piero, he's basically bombing down the wing and he's got Edgar Davids marking him tightly. And the ball comes in, he basically backheel volleys a pass across to some Juve teammates. So, yeah, he could service his companions.
And this was pre-injury Del Piero as well. And obviously Del Piero continued to be a phenomenal player afterwards. But what Del Piero could do back then, in terms of technical ability, in terms of creativity, he really played with a freedom, and a freedom that was afforded him because he had, you know, the two other strikers, like I said, Vialli and Ravanelli. I don't think anybody, well, especially Vialli, would ever fault the effort that they put in out there, the leadership, the strength.
30 minutes in, Juve's pressure, Juve's getting in their face attitude pays off when De Boer and Van der Sar fail to understand each other, and Ravanelli takes advantage and puts Juve in the lead.
Attenzione, c'è un po' di imprecisione, Ravanelli, attenzione, attenzione, gol! Sfruttando un errore di Van de Boer, Ravanelli porta in vantaggio la Juventus quando siamo al dodicesimo minuto.
Peruzzi's making some brilliant saves, but just before half-time, he gets caught out when a free kick. Peruzzi seems unclear on how to deal with it, so he basically fists it away. It bounces off Ciro Ferrara, and Jari Litmanen steals in and puts it away.
The thing about Angelo Peruzzi was that he was obviously an atypical footballer, in the sense that, I don't want to use the words the fat goalkeeper, but
he was built big.
He was a big guy. It's like in, you know, you remember in Pulp Fiction, where you say, like, you know, the dude Samoan. You know, Peruzzi is like sort of like Italy's Samoan.
Yeah, but he's not Neville Southall big. He's just like a big unit.
Yes,
massive.
And no. I mean, Paolo Di Canio writes in his excellent autobiography, which you probably should read. It's a wonderful book. So he roomed with Angelo Peruzzi at Juve, and he would wake up at night sometimes, and he'd see Peruzzi would go into his drawer where he'd hidden like salami and like cheese from his hometown and
he
stuff.
Played hide the salami with Paolo Di Canio.
Exactly. And he'd be kind of, you know, and he'd sort of be munching away, and Paolo would think it was hilarious. And Paolo, obviously being very supportive and constructive towards his younger teammates, would be like, ha ha, you lard ass, what are you doing?
But Peruzzi was a fantastic keeper though.
Because he had those incredible reflexes.
Right.
You know, and today we're used to keepers who are sort of tall and rangy, you know, the Ter Stegen, De Gea type prototype. But Peruzzi had tremendous positioning and he had tremendous reflexes. You know, what he, you know, maybe couldn't do is jump, you know, 10 yards up into the air. And that's why often he would punch it away. But he was a great goalkeeper. And he's one of those guys who I think a lot of people really know their goalkeeping in Italy thought like, well, you know, if we could have made him more svelte, he would have been the best keeper in the world.
Right.
There's some debates about that. You get into biomechanics. The guy was just built differently, but he was much, much loved by his teammates and I think a really underrated goalkeeper in many ways.
Anyway, Juve, who, by the way, are wearing that classic 90s European strip, the blue jerseys with the yellow stars on their shoulders. Always love that one. Raining chances in on the other goalkeeper, Van der Sar, who will, in years to come, himself turn out for Juve. He spends a couple of seasons there. But as the game wears on, changes are made. Jugovic comes on, the vastly underrated Jugovic.
Yeah.
Patrick Kluivert comes on for Ajax. Di Livio's on for Paulo Sousa. And there's just pressure and pressure and pressure. Del Piero is having one of those finals that he often used to have, having chance after chance. And indeed, about 30 seconds before the end of extra time, just gets the perfect opportunity. He absolutely lashes the ball in. and Van der Sar just almost kind of sucks it into his belly. I don't know quite how. He just kills it dead with his midriff.
Yeah, that was one of the most unorthodox stops that you're going to see for Van der Sar, but also very brave. And what's interesting, too, I think, for Van der Sar is that season. The year before, Van der Sar had arguably been the best goalkeeper in Europe. That season, he'd had some ups and downs. In fact, there was even some people suggesting that his backup goalkeeper, who I'm going to name check here just because I love his name, Fred Grimm, was, you know, maybe he should get a shot and whatever else. But I thought Van der Sar really came up big then.
Del Piero wasn't the only player missing chances. Gianluca Vialli as well, there's a comment from him afterwards. I'm not sure if this is something you talked about with him. He said that night I was more nervous than any of my teammates because I'd played in what was then the European Cup final in 92, Sampdoria against Barcelona.
And he missed a crucial chance in that game, which would have given Sampdoria the European Cup.
And that was his last game for Samp, and he was aware of it, and he felt that influenced his performance. And once again, this was his final game for a team because he would be leaving Juve that summer.
That's right. That was the one where the situation where, as Luca puts it, they approached him before the final. His contract was up.
Who did the triad?
Yeah, the evil triad of Antonio Giraldo, Roberto Mettica, and the most likable of the three, according to La Pielcan, Luciano Moggi. And they said, oh, yeah, you're great. Yeah, no, don't worry. We'll get the contract done. Sure, yeah, don't worry. And as Luca puts it, they gave me an offer, but it was the kind of offer which said to me, yeah, you'd best leave. We don't really want you around. And I think he really took this very personally because, you know, he was the team captain. You know, he delivered the title the year before in 94-95. He would go on to, obviously, know this at the time, but he would captain them to a European Cup. And he felt that he had put a lot on the line when he left Sampdoria to come to Juventus. And he came to a different Juventus, a Juventus that was pre-Moggi and Giraldo and Bettega and these sort of characters. He would have stayed. He was ready to stay. But in those conditions, he felt he had to go. And of course, he ended up going to Chelsea, who he would then manage. And for a while, be the most successful manager in Chelsea history. Until, of course, the special one rolled into town. But that, of course, is a story for a different time.
For another time. Because we've got some penalties to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
They start with Edgar Davids for Ajax. Oh, no. And then all sorts of penalties get scored. But Ajax miss another one. And then up steps Vladimir Jugovic, who's one of the coolest operators around. And he's got that half. This kick, it's down to him. Are Juve going to win? Can they seal the Champions League with this kick? He just walks up with like a half smile on his face and bangs it straight past Van der Sar, who guesses right, but there's no stopping that one. And Juve are champions for only the second time in their history.
Yeah, and obviously the first time in their history was Heysel, which I think for many reasons, and it's easy to say after the fact, and obviously there was a lot of hypocrisy there, but you know, this was a victory, you know, on the pitch, albeit via penalties, but it was a victory on the pitch. And it's not something that, you know, came in a match which really should never have been played.
1996, and they've still yet to add another one. They went back to the final the following year and the year after that, 97, when they got beaten by a Borussia Dortmund side, now featuring
Lars Ricken.
Now featuring Paulo Sousa, I was going to mention, but yeah, sure.
Yeah, by the way, in some ways, it's pretty remarkable what, you know, for all this stuff, all those people who go and suck up to Luciano Moggi and talk about, oh, those guys were so smart, and, you know, leaving aside all the calciopoli and all the dubious stuff, right? They let Paulo Sousa go.
Who was player of the season that year, wasn't he?
Yeah, and they let Gianluca Vialli go. And then, yeah, sure, you reach those two European Cup finals, whoop-de-hoo, and you won a few more things, but then you also kind of entered into that weird death spiral where the Rome teams won the titles and whatever else. And just to say, it's not like everything that they touch was gold. And then, of course, they signed Zidane, who would deliver Serie A titles but come up short in Europe.
97 against Borussia Dortmund, 98 in Amsterdam against Real Madrid, a 1-0 defeat with Predrag Mijatovic. Ravanelli leaving that summer as well, going to Borough. Extraordinary, for about £7 million.
which was a lot of money back then.
Right. Viali went to Chelsea, Sosa to Dortmund. In their place came the likes of Zidane, Boksic, young Christian Vieri. Eventually, Edgar Davids turned up after going to... It was the following season, I think, Davids went to Milan, was it?
Yeah.
And that didn't work out.
Ran into Fabio Capello.
Right. And also Billy Costa-Curta, who didn't get... It wasn't Costa-Curta the guy who came out and said he's a bad apple and he'll spoil the whole bunch?
I think so. Billy always very, very forthright with his opinions. But I think in many ways, though, Davids wouldn't have fit that Milan team and what they were going to do. And I think also Capello was kind of like, all right, I can't deal with this guy. Because, you know, we remember old Davids and how good he was. Young Davids had his issues too, of a different kind.
Yeah. One or two incidents in the street in Milan, outside nightclubs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and sequestering himself away in hotels and things like that.
Right. If 96 marked a watershed for Juventus, it was the same only more so for Ajax. In December 95, we'd had the Bosman ruling, which allowed European players to transfer on a free once their contracts were up, which nowadays is completely normal. But before that, you were entirely beholden. Players were entirely beholden to their clubs. Even once their contract had expired, the clubs would still regard them as part of their assets. So for a club like Ajax, Bosman, the way I understood it, hit them particularly hard. I mean, they lost their entire squad within a couple of seasons.
Yeah, I think there were different forces concurrently at work. Obviously, players suddenly had a lot more leverage in contractual negotiations and whatever else, because the prospect of leaving on a free transfer meant that anybody who had any kind of market could just go and say, all right, you want to lock me in so that you can get a big transfer fee when I go? Fine, that's going to cost you a lot of money. So that really raised costs for a lot of clubs. Remember, Ajax at the time, they were still at the old stadium, De Meer, I think it was, before the Amsterdam Arena had been built. That was part of it. But the other thing was the limits on foreigners, which in Holland were always pretty loose, but because they were lifted entirely elsewhere, that then, and obviously in England they were very loose, but in Spain and in Italy, you know, they were pretty strict. You could have three guys playing on the pitch. That then created a situation where clubs like Real Madrid and Barcelona and Milan could just go and stockpile top foreign players. And that obviously eventually made them better because the pool of players they could pick from were much better. And so it became tougher and tougher for Ajax to compete. What Ajax did, which I thought was kind of neat, and they tried to get around it. They said, all right, well, we're going to turn Bosman to our advantage, right? We're going to get really creative in our scouting. And this is often forgotten, but Ajax spent a ton of money for the time and for Ajax, a lot of the money they got from all the players they lost, on sort of superstar 18-year-olds. One of them, of course, being Christian Kivu, and the other one being Zlatan Ibrahimovic. They kind of blew their money early, thinking that it would work out. And it did to some degree, but you still had Bosman, and it just became very difficult for them to compete at anywhere near the same level.
Right, they've never been back to the Champions League final since, although they did make the semi-finals the following season, 97, when they were put out by Juventus. The other story from the 96 final, one that indeed came up when the draw was made for this year's quarterfinals, was the notion that Juve had an unfair advantage in that game. There is some evidence. Indeed, there was even a court verdict that Juve, between 94 and 98, had a criminal plan to affect games by the illicit use of pharmaceuticals. Now, this court verdict was given on the 29th of May 2007. It so happened that the statute of limitations had seen the events in question actually expire in terms of being a valid criminal charge on the 1st of April of that year. So it was exceptionally good timing from Juve's point of view. But this really, in the noughties, was the other big Juve scandal. You had Calciopoli, which happened in 2006. But relating to events back in the 90s, you had the whole scandal about the doctor, the man who the triad had appointed as club doctor, Riccardo Agricola, and what he'd been doing with players. A lot of suggestions that they'd use blood doping even. What do the Juve players say about this?
Naturally, they get pretty defensive about this, from Zidane to Vialli. They were all called to testify. To a man, they say that, you know, they weren't aware of anything. You know, when they took a whole bunch of supplements, which is pretty standard for professional athletes, you don't know what's in them. They also felt that during the trial, and there's video, I think Zidane getting really annoyed about this, because at one point they ask him, like, you know, on or around September 17th, 1997, Mr. Zidane, were you given 120 milligrams of blah, 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 and 16 milligrams of blah, blah, blah? And he's like, you know, this is like 4 years later. He's like, how the hell am I supposed to remember that? You know? And they felt that it was a very punitive, vindictive thing, which really put the players out there. I think, you know, having covered this a little bit in the book I wrote with Gianluca Vialli, I think when we report on this stuff, there's still a general sense in the population. They get bored with this very easily, quickly, right? They just think, oh, look, magic pill, take pill, is cheating.
Right.
So, bad dopers. I don't think even Agricola would dispute this, is that Juve tried to gain an edge by whatever combination of pharmaceuticals that they could get.
Right.
Right. They were careful.
Creatine was nice.
Creatine, which was not, but that wasn't a banned substance, right?
Yeah.
That was, and if used improperly, that ended up just making you fat.
Right.
So, you know, they used prescription medications when maybe from an ethical perspective, they shouldn't have been taking them. But what they would point out was that A, they never failed a blood test.
Yeah.
B, based on their own blood records, I think there were three players, Di Livio, Deschamps, and one other, who had levels that were suspiciously high, and the others did not. Now, the other thing is, these were Juve's own records, which they kept. And Juve's defense has long been, well, wait a minute, if we knew we were cheating, why would we keep blood records that showed that we were cheating? Why would we keep this evidence? So, there's no question, I think, that they certainly violated the spirit of the law.
Uh-huh.
Whether they violated the letter of the law, to what degree they gained an unfair advantage, you know, that's stuff for others to figure out.
Right. I mean, Lance Armstrong always used that defense. I never failed a blood test. But it was certainly the perception in the 90s that Italy actually had among the tougher anti-doping regimes, certainly tougher than the kind of checks that were applied to English footballers.
Yes. Very few people were testing properly back then.
But Italy, to a large extent, were, although there were then subsequent scandals about what had happened to all the records at, like, Aquamarcia, where a lot of the testing.
By the way, of all the testing facilities in the world, would you send it to Aquamarcia? Means rotten water. Like, yeah, that's really where I want to go and send my medical care.
The other thing to say, from Juve's point of view, is that they did seem to have an extra gear compared to other teams in those days, but the reason that a lot of people pointed to, and certainly they pointed to, was the Marine.
Yes, Giampiero Vintrone, whose assistant, Antonio Pintus, then later became a fitness coach at Chelsea and is now at Real Madrid, actually. They said, look, we trained better and harder. We had more athletic players, and we sought out more athletic players. And again, I mentioned those guys before versus Ajax's players. You know, Antonio Conte, if you remember him as a footballer, and Didier Deschamps, those guys were simply better athletes than Jari Litmanen and Ronald de Boer. The other guys were better footballers. You know, there was a trade-off. They
right.
went for this kind of approach.
Physicality.
For physicality, for athleticism, for stamina.
Mm.
That was what they believed in.
Do you know what? That was 1996. I'm sure there's a bunch of other things we could draw from that, but there's been a whole load of things that have happened in this year's Serie A competition, which we should touch on. So we'll be back to talk about that after a little bit of this.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Right, Serie A this weekend. I'm going to go quick fire on you here, Gab.
Boom.
Juve didn't win the title.
No, they didn't. They ended up, it's that stage of the season where I think arguably the only starter that they would have had out there was, I think, Desilio. They played Spal. They didn't even play that badly. They played four dudes who I think most people would have never heard of unless you happen to be related to Grigorios Castanos or that ridiculous Nicolussi Caviglia guy.
Well, this English player as well.
Oh, yes. Stefano Mavididi, mm-hmm. Yes. It's readers of the Young Gunners blog will be very familiar with him. They dug way deep. They said, let's throw out the scrubs. It annoyed other teams because they lost 2-1 at Spal. Spal, of course, theoretically in the relegation race. I don't have a problem with Allegri's decision making there. You know, you earn the right to be in that position. But equally, it kind of makes what happened on Wednesday when, you know, when he comes out and says, well, we look tired. I'm like, yeah, because you had a whole week off. Maybe that's why you look tired. Whereas, you know, Ajax only 3-4 days off.
All right. Well, if you enjoyed that, Gab, what did you make of the fact that Chievo are now relegated?
Oh, it's fantastic. I'm glad. I hope they never come back until they get a proper president who starts following the rules.
3-1 defeat for the Flying Donkeys. Away at Napoli, the relegation situation.
Napoli bouncing back after a disappointment at the Emirates, of course.
That's true. Frosinone are almost down. Looks like being between them and Empoli.
Frosinone, though, giving Inter a scare. And this is the other, like, I don't know. All of a sudden, Inter afterwards, they reacted as if, like, oh, look, yeah, everything's fine. Nothing to see here. Look, we're third. Ha ha. You know, look, Spalletti's getting the job done. Like, I think the main thing to cheer from that game, if you're Inter, is the fact that Perisic and Icardi seem to be buddies again, or they can contain themselves at least long enough to go and embrace in public.
Lautaro Martinez seems to be a valid option up front.
An alternative.
Yeah.
But Frosinone playing really well.
Okay, but they're still very much looking in the hot seat for a trip down to Serie B. Empoli also in trouble. Bologna as well, only 2 points above the drop. Udinese is 3 points above, but they have a game in hand. Then you've got Genoa and Parma. Udinese, like Bologna, benefiting hugely from a change in manager. Mihalovic coming in at Bologna. Igor Tudor. At Udinese. Bologna holding Fiorentina and their new manager, Vincenzo Montella, to a 0-0 draw in the, I'm going to call it the Derby of the Apennines. Is that fair?
Yeah, they're the Derby della Variante di Valico, which is stretch of motorway.
Samp won the Derby della Lanterna 2-0.
There's a surprise.
Yep. Dzeko scored for the first time at home in the league for almost a year in a big win for Roma.
Two wins in a row. The old guy's getting it done. First De Rossi and then Dzeko. It's weird because he's been playing Dzeko and Schick up front. And so you figure out what's the best way to provide service to them. And he's not able to do it. The good news is they're not conceding as much, but it's I always think back to, you know, it's the old story of the blanket that's either, you know, you pull it up and then you're nice and cozy up front but your feet get cold, or you have nice warm feet and then you freeze your nose off.
Shorter players, that's the answer.
Exactly.
Okay. Milan beat Lazio 1-0 in a largely forgettable game, I'm gonna say, on Saturday.
Forgettable apart from Lazio's whining and whinging at the end.
Yeah, which, of course, the end. So Kessié scores the penalty. At the final whistle, there's a rissa, there's a proper set-to between both sets of players and various people from the bench and that kind of thing. But that all gets calmed down to the extent that players swap shirts.
In the week before, Acerbi had given an interview where he says, you know, and we should go even further with the backstory. Francesco Acerbi is a guy, one of those Italian guys who everybody loves because he's a super nice guy, he's intelligent, he speaks well. You know, he beat cancer as well, twice, I think.
Of the testicles,
cancer,
right?
Yes, a testicular cancer twice. And he's somebody everybody likes. And he gave an interview where he was maybe a little cocky, and he said, yeah, well, I think, you know, in every area of the pitch, we're superior to Milan, I think we're going to win. And then Bakayoko came back and sort of needled him and said, oh, really? Well, we'll see on the pitch. It was a bit of a back and forth on social media. Everything's fine. And Acerbi, the final whistle, says, let me swap shirts with him because I'm a nice guy. And that's fine. And then Milan go to celebrate under the curva where their ultras are. And Kessié and Bakayoko, Tweedledee and Tweedledum, decide to go and hold up the shirt they just got from a charity, point to it, and laugh. Ha, 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 ha.
Like a trophy, almost as if they were ultras and they seized the flag from the other end.
The natural thing to do at that point is what I would have done if I'd been a charity, is I would have taken Bakayoko's shirt, sorry, and said, oh, wait, let me drop my pants and go and wipe my butt with it and leave it here, right? Since this is the level. There was a whole to-do. Achadbi got really upset afterwards, saying that this foments hatred. I kind of think the whole thing was really badly overblown, in the sense that, no, it was not a classy gesture from the two of them. Midan apologized afterwards. Musacchio and others tried to calm them down. Equally, though, that doesn't foment hatred. That's just kind of being stupid. That's what you might call spithousery in this country, James.
Would I call it that?
Well, some people would.
I'd term it banter.
Bants, yes, yeah. Mad bants. But there was a whole other thing that went on just before that, because there were several refereeing decisions that I think they were all correct. And, you know, even at the end, Ricardo Rodriguez on Immobile was correct. And the referee, Gianluca Rocchi, I think is a very good referee. There's a massive scuffle at the final whistle. Lucas Leiva, former Liverpool star Lucas Leiva, he got into trouble, and I think he's been fined, although he's appealing it. Because
was this Ugo Levi that he had a go?
This is Ugo Levi. Now, for those who don't know, Ugo Levi is a guy who, he may still work in Milan's press office. I don't know.
I believe so. I didn't know. He was back in my day. He was there. He was the...
Well, in the sort of the general melee, he, I don't know, told people to calm down. He somehow got involved. And basically, Lucas Leiva is alleged, and he denies this, to say to him, sit down and shut up. Ugo's a big guy and he's in a wheelchair, so you can tell he's in a wheelchair, so maybe the sit-down thing isn't, you know, I think if you just leave it to the shut-up, not really necessary. But I don't think Lucas Leiva was mocking him. And I should point out, Lucas Leiva denies saying this.
That was certainly an eventful weekend. This coming one, as the relegation battle draws to a climax, and the same goes for the top four places, Inter are taking on Roma Saturday night. That's going to be huge.
Yeah.
It's usually a good game as well, Inter against Roma. Napoli-Atalanta could well be an exciting one. Oh, my word. Saturday before Inter kick-off against Roma, Juve taking on Fiorentina. Vincenzo Montella, only his second game in charge of La Viola, and one of their biggest fixtures of the year.
I'll say this. Juve will obviously win the title, but if you look at Juve's run-in, it's actually a really tough run-in.
Well, it's funny you should say that, Gab, because this weekend they're at home to Fiorentina, then they travel to San Siro to take on Inter, after which, my word, they got the Turin derby against Torino, a Torino team who are doing pretty nicely, thank you, surprisingly, under Walter Mazzarri. They follow that up with, oh my goodness, a trip to the Stadio Olimpico to take on Roma, who may or may not be a worthwhile, valid, ongoing football team at that point. They finish the season with Atalanta, and then it's their bogey fixture. The last day of the season, a Sampdoria, the team who always take points off Juve.
So, look, they need a point to mathematically secure the title.
But I'm looking at that run. Where's it going to come?
Well, it's funny. Imagine how exciting it would have been if some of those earlier results of the season they got away with hadn't gone their way. And Juve need to metabolize this trauma and move on very quickly.
Because if Fiorentina win this weekend and Napoli beat Atalanta, all of a sudden, you're looking at a 14-point gap.
But it's not. That's not the point. It's going to happen. They will get a point there. Hmm. But they're down and out psychologically. And, you know, Fiorentina don't want Juve celebrating in their house, right? So you're facing all these games where people will be motivated to beat you just to twist the knife, and you're playing pretty good teams along the way. So
it's extraordinary.
The whole season could end with a series of ugly draws, right, you know, defeats and stuff like that.
They've already blown the Coppa Italia and the Champions League. Could the Scudetto be next? Do hope you enjoy it. It's all available in the UK on Premier Sports, of course. Or you can join us next Wednesday when James Horncastle should be back with us in the flesh. And we'll be discussing some other random bit of Italian
Horncastle
history.
Castle incarnate.
Nice.
Wow.
All right.
He will rise again and become flesh in fulfillment of James Richardson's words.
That's what's going to happen.
If you have a beard, he'd look more like Jesus than either you or me, right?
But not more than Moreno Torricelli.
No.
Anyway, listener, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you, Gabriele Marcotti and producer Charlie. For now, from all of us here, it's arrivederci. Campionato di calcio.
You've been listening to Galazzo, the totally Italian football show. It's a Muddy Knees Media production, and for sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Check out our other football shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audio Boom, and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience with a simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelance profiles, get help drafting a job post, or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them to take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com today and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com. Upwork.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your 2 free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your 2 free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.